Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Another day is here and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America N.A., member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to A Celtic State of Mind. My name's Paul John Dykes, and tonight I'm delighted to be joined by Alex Horsburgh. Alex, welcome to A Celtic State of Mind.
Great, Paul. It's great to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
We've not been awarded the league title and we won't be able to play the Scottish Cup semi-final. What's your thoughts on where we are with that at the moment? I know some of the other countries are making decisions across Europe.
Well, I said it on Twitter a couple of weeks ago, Paul, and I don't mind putting it out there. Just call it. Give Celtic the title. I think there's too much humming and hawing, as we say in Scotland. I'm a wee bit miffed by the 14-14-14 setup that prevents teams from being relegated. It also blocks out Celtic, Hearts and Brewer Rangers coming up from the pyramid. And, you know, I've been a football fan for 50 years, Paul, and obviously strange times, there's that cliche again. But I just say, for goodness sake, call it and get it out of the way. I don't think we should abandon the season. I think they've abandoned the season in France. It would be nice if we could play out the games that are remaining behind closed doors. But, you know, any sensible person, any sensible neutral, and I am a neutral, would say, you know, I don't think Celtic were going to be caught. So call it, you know, for goodness sake, call it. Either void it or call it, but do something for goodness sake, because, you know, I put up on Twitter today, as a football fan of 50 years, this is the first time I've been a wee bit bored with Scottish football. And it's not because of the lockdown. It's because they just won't call it. I think it's the 26th of May they have to call it. Mm-hmm. I think they have to call it by the 26th of May. So, you know, best foot forward and call it. And for me, it's Celtic's title. If it was, you know, Rangers in Celtic's position at the moment, I'd still be calling for the title to be called. This is where I start to get a wee bit, this is where I back off from it now, because, you know, over 50 years of watching Scottish football, I've heard a lot of conspiracy theories, and there's also, you know, the first sport in Scotland is football, and the second sport is conspiracy theories about football. And I've really got to the stage now where when I see, you know, coercion, conspiracy, bullying, I'm just, you know, I just, you know, the thing that I scream now is, call it. For goodness sake, call it. Call the title and say, you know, it's Celtic's title, or if it was Rangers in the same position, it's Rangers' title. Call it, for goodness sake, and let's finish this season, because I don't think we can really, my own personal opinion is I think this lockdown, this situation with COVID-19 will go on until probably July or August. I don't think we'll get these outstanding games played, so I think we have to call it. The soap opera for me, I'm not as prolific as you on Twitter, but I'm on it maybe more than I was this time last year. And I just kind of despair at all the chat back and forward about, Rangers said this, Celtic said this, claim, counterclaim. I just want to see this season decided. I even saw one former player saying, don't call Celtic champions, call them winners. Don't name them champions, name them winners. And again, that, only in Scotland. Just as a neutral, I just want to see this season finished. And I think they should call it. I think they should have the guts to call it. And in fact, I think they should have had the guts to call all four divisions.
Yeah, before now. And the thing that you're mentioning there in relation to calling the title, I had a very interesting discussion, Alex, with David Lowe, probably 4 or 5 weeks ago now, the financial advisor of Fergus McCann when Fergus took over Celtic back in 1994. And, David was looking at the ramifications of where we are in relation to the finances of Scottish football, which, at the best of times, Alex, can be fairly precarious. I mean, you look over the last 15 years, for example, the amount of clubs who have faced financial ruin, gone into administration, etc. And I think the one thing that people are overlooking is the fact that, we do have to get the title argument resolved, but the clubs that are really going to be looking down the barrel of a gun right now, I think, will be far more than people realise. There's going to be clubs that really do live, week to week, month to month, Alex, and if we've got 3 or 4 months of no income through the gate and all the average revenue that every fan actually spends when they're at a game, there's going to be a lot of clubs who will be facing financial peril. Do you think when we get back to playing football, we will have a full complement of sides?
Well, in a funny sort of way, I think we will, because I think the way Scottish football is set up, obviously there was the Charlie Nicholas comment about the smaller clubs have too big a say and all the rest of it. But I think these clubs are already finding a way to survive. And a lot of them, a lot of the smaller clubs are getting very creative on social media. I've seen Cowdenbeath getting very creative. Berwick Rangers, I know they're low in league now, but Berwick Rangers have got the commentator Derek Ray involved as an ambassador for their club. And I think if we can get to maybe July and get things back to semi-normality in life in July, I think these clubs will survive. But I think, as I said to you in a tweet recently, Paul, I'm not in favour of culling clubs. A lot of people have this mindset of, Scotland's too wee for 42 league clubs. Well, Scottish football is as much about the football community at a smaller level as it is between Celtic and Rangers. I made a flip joke on Twitter. I said maybe the best league lineup would be a top league of two with them both playing each other forever. And I was talking about Celtic and Rangers there. But, that was just a wee kind of flip comment. But I think these smaller clubs are a lot more savvy now, especially on social media. And I think we'll just about make it. I think we'll get them back. And, of course, in a funny sort of way, they have voted for self-preservation with this 3 leagues of 14.
The comment I made, I was going to bring that up because it does spark off a very interesting debate, Alex, and I'm all for that. A friend of mine, I think I might have mentioned this to you before, but a good friend of mine is a season ticket holder at Central Park. And I've been to Central Park on a number of occasions in a previous life, in a previous job, not because I supported Cowdenbeath or anybody else in Fife, but I've been in the stadium a hell of a lot. And I realise what it takes to function as a club, the size of Cowdenbeath and with the attendances that a club like Cowdenbeath get. I was also given a really quite concerning insight into the running of Dunfermline Athletic when they were in administration back in 2012. And I realised at that time, in Fife, a fairly small area, there's 4 senior clubs, 4 stadiums, 4 different businesses all relying on a much smaller population. And I think the tweet that got quite a few comments, particularly from kind of smaller clubs, fans of what you would call provincial clubs, the comment was, should clubs consider either merging, ground sharing? The third one, which I didn't put up, is a business alliance, non-football, Alex, whereby, they can share the loads in terms of, scouting or training facilities or groundsmen, that kind of thing. Do you think we'll ever get to that stage where clubs realise that we don't need 4 stadiums in Fife and perhaps 2 the clubs should marry up?
Well, I think clubs can ground share, but I don't think mergers will ever happen. I mean, I'm old enough to remember George Farm, the ex-Dunfermline manager. He came up with an idea for a Fife United in the early 1970s. The pernickety nature, the contrary nature of Scottish football, or the counter nature, as they would say in Fife, of Scottish football, is that if you decided overnight Dunfermline and Cowdenbeath are going to merge, Dunfermline fans would come out in their droves and say, what are we doing merging with this wee diddy club? And Cowdenbeath fans would come out. In fact, Cowdenbeath fans, who haven't been at games for years, would come out and say, oh, no, we want to preserve the club for the town because it's one of the few things that keeps us on the map. So this is, again, this is the contrary nature of Scottish football. You'd see people coming out of the woodwork that have never had any interest in the team for years saying, oh, no, we want the status quo. And to cut a long story short, Paul, I just don't think you'll ever see mergers of football clubs. I think a lot of football fans, even at the lower level, I think they'd rather see their teams go out of business than merge. You know, Cowdenbeath and Dunfermline merging, non-starter. East Fife Wraith Rovers, non-starter. Motherwell Airdrie, never going to happen. And, you saw what happened with Cali and Thistle when they tried to get into the Scottish League. I mean, that caused a lot of rifts in Inverness before they finally merged. So, yeah, to answer your question, I just don't think mergers will ever happen. I think it messes with the DNA of football.
I think the other thing that I failed to mention, it's very much the flip of my argument, is there was a study fairly recently. It was on the SFA's website in relation to the economy that a football club the size of Ayr United brings to the local community. And that was interesting in itself, because the figures that they were actually listing were astronomical in relation to the size of the club, Alex. So I think economically it may actually not be viable for the surrounding businesses and the surrounding areas. But in the back of my mind, I do have some doubts about some of the clubs who are maybe living beyond their means and they may not get through it. But again, that's the prophet of doom in me. And that's me looking at reports that football will be played behind closed doors until, you know, January and that type of thing, Alex. But we haven't had anything confirmed. Now, you're talking about Cowdenbeath. You're a Cowdenbeath fan yourself. Celtic's captain is a Fifer, not far away from Cowdenbeath, and in actual fact from Hillabeath. And Fife does have a rich kind of tapestry of producing footballers. When you think about going back to Hillabeath, you drive in there, you see Slim Jim Baxter looking down nonchalantly from his wee pedestal that he's got there. You've got Johnny Thompson and various others, George Conley from High Valleyfield. Do you still think that the small villages are producing footballers like they used to back in the day?
Scott Brown might be the last of a very long line, Paul. There's other guys as well. Tommy Hutchison was from Cardenden, played for Scotland, Coventry, Manchester City. David Speedy was from Glenrothes, played for Chelsea. I've got a feeling Scott Brown may be the last of a long line.
It's a shame, really, because, I mean, interestingly enough, the names I didn't mention the likes of Tommy Hutchison and David Speedy, and there'll be plenty of others. Bert Payton, for example, from High Valleyfield, and I've had the pleasure of speaking to Bert. Bert went away down to Leeds United. As you say, it's a long line. And I remember, even when we were younger, 20 years ago maybe playing football, there was a few guys that came through and played and made the grade. John Potter, again, another High Valleyfield boy who's now at Hibs as Jack Ross's assistant. But it's unfortunate. Why do you think that is? Because the villages used to, you know, produce player after player.
Well, I'll tell you a story about High Valleyfield, Paul, because, I used to date a girl from High Valleyfield when I was in my late teens, and I had no concept of the village before I spent some time in it. And one of the things, I don't know if it's still the case, but back then, in the early 80s, there was a lot of people in High Valleyfield that had a bit of a West of Scotland accent. I quizzed somebody about this once, and they said, well, it's because High Valleyfield basically came out of Ayrshire Miners, you know, transplanting themselves to Fife. And, of course, Cowdenbeath Football Club were formed by the Pollock family, who were also from Ayrshire, settled in the town and came to Fife partly for business, partly to work in the mines. And, you know, maybe there's something in the West of Scotland DNA. Maybe I've got a feeling, I don't know for certain, I'm not on the same level as a Bob Crampsey or anything like that, but I've got a feeling that a lot of people migrated from the West of Scotland and kind of brought football to the East in a funny sort of way. And and then, of course, you have that other affinity, you know, the pilgrimage to Cardenden and John Thompson And well, that's my theory anyway. I think when people from the west of Scotland migrated to the east, they maybe brought, I think football was already popular, but I think they brought football with them, and they brought an attitude with them. And maybe that answers your question.
I think it's a very good theory, because when you go to High Valley Field, and it was always a boxing and a football mining village, as many of the mining villages were, Alex. There's so many Maguires that obviously are coming over from Donegal via Hamilton. So you're absolutely right. There is a kind of West Coast twang to the accent, and that, I think that's where it comes from. And perhaps they brought the footballing ability and the love for football with them. But going back to George Conley, I believe, having read an article that you produced during the week, that you've seen the great man in one of your first European memories. You watched the game between Celtic and Leeds United, which George became famous for.
Yeah, it was actually the second leg. I have memories. I saw the Elland Road game later on. I kind of got familiar with the Elland Road game later on, but my first football memory, and I'm showing my age here, was sitting with my late father in a house in Cowdenbeath on a Wednesday night. I don't know if the game was live or if it was recorded, but it was Celtic versus Leeds. Celtic won 2-1, of course, 3-1 on aggregate, went through to the European Cup final. As far as I can remember, that is the first football bonding experience I had with my dad. My dad wasn't a huge football fan back then, but I was starting to get interested. The funny thing was, he ended up going to more live games than me, you know, in the 90s before he died at the end of that decade. But, yeah. Celtic Leeds, 136,000 at Hampden.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's Olly.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
It was the first time I had any concept of Celtic, the hoops, the crowd, the National Stadium. And yeah, it's the first game I can remember watching on TV with my dad. And then, of course, it was the World Cup that year as well. We watched the World Cup together, and that was it. I was a football fan.
When you look at that kind of period, what an introduction, Alex, you know, to see the green and white hoops, as it would have been, because it was the colour footage, wasn't it? The Hampden game that was on the TV. The one thing I always think about that game, 136,000, European record. And that was at a time when a lot of fans were getting carried over the turnstiles, and you know, people working on the turnstiles were maybe making a few quid themselves, but no, actually recording some of the numbers. So it was probably closer to 150,000, which is quite frightening to think, you know.
Yeah, it was incredible. I mean, we had a black and white telly. I did see some of the World Cup that year in colour, because the women down the road had a colour TV, and I think it was the mixture of the colour TV, the football, the Brazil shirt. That West Germany shirt always kind of caught my eye as well, with a badge on it and stuff. And that these are the things that developed me into a football fan. And then in 71, I guess that was the first time I became aware of Celtic versus Rangers, Scottish Cup final, the draw at Hampden, the replay. Both games are on TV as far as I can remember. And then, you know, and actually that year, 71 as well, we had the Ibrox disaster, and a lot of the people that were killed were actually from Fife. So that again cemented my interest in football. But yeah, Celtic Leeds, 1970, Battle of Britain, Celtic 2, Leeds United 1, Billy Bremner putting Leeds up, Leeds 1 up. And then I think it was, well, John Hughes certainly got the winner. Was it Bertie Auld that got the equaliser?
Bobby Murdoch,
yeah. That is the first football bonding experience I had with my dad. And then by 71, we were going to games together, and I was getting lifted over the turnstiles, albeit at Cowdenbeath, Dunfermline and Raith Rovers, mm-hmm. because we used to uh, We used to alternate between the three, but we ended up going to Cowdenbeath mostly because we were both from Cowdenbeath.
An interesting thing as well, you're watching George Connolly playing an integral part actually in that victory over Leeds over the two legs. You know, 4 years later, he was in the qualification squad for Scotland, who finally qualified for the 1974 World Cup finals and would have gone had he not broken his ankle. Meanwhile, Alex, his brother Joe, also of High Valleyfield, played with Cowdenbeath. Now, that might have been a wee bit too early for you to have seen him in action, but there is a game where Celtic went to, it was for the opening of, or the unveiling rather, of the floodlights at Central Park, Celtic versus Cowdenbeath at Central Park. George Connolly was playing centre-half, Joe Connolly was playing centre-forward for Cowdenbeath. And I suppose it goes back to our point before about the great talents that were coming out of the small villages around about that time. You mentioned West Germany, and George was often compared to the great Franz Beckenbauer. Just how good was Big George?
Oh yeah, fantastic. And of course, I mean, a curial talent and one of these guys, almost kind of George Best-like. He kind of, you know, he kind of left the game too early. Certainly remember the goal at Leeds because, you know, I found out about the game probably a couple of years later after the Hampden game, but I know for a fact that the English press had written Celtic off. Leeds United had rested players before they took on Celtic that night at Elland Road. There is a story, you'll probably know this better than me, Paul, something about Don Reavy giving Celtic orange socks to try and kind of throw them off their game. And, you know, Celtic had to change their socks that night. Referee made them change their socks. Don Reavy thought it was a good idea to give them orange socks. But there you go, 45 seconds on the clock, bang. George Connolly passed Gary Sprake, and the whole of the English press really, you know, they kind of had their lips buttoned that night, you know.
That's gone down in folklore. You had the jock Steen, Don Revy, and by all accounts, Steen and Revy were quite friendly. But when they went down, it was the old mind game straight away where the referee realises that there's a clash of socks, both teams wearing white socks. So Leeds, with Celtic not taking a change kit, Leeds offered them their two change colours. One was blue and one was dark orange. So Steen took the orange ones and said that they would shine like gold under the floodlights. You know, he always had a snippet or a soundbite, Jock Steen, didn't he? And it certainly did Celtic no harm whatsoever to wear the orange socks. It looked green, white, and orange, so that was fine.
Yeah, it did look green, white, and gold, if you like. And here's another random fact for you: Don Reavy married a woman from Lochgilly. So there's another random Fife fact for you there.
I did not know that he married into Fife stock. Alex, there you go. We're learning all the time. Loughgelly, brilliant. I used to travel in the Loughgelly Celtic Supporters Club bus, and it's now called the Arthur McKenna CSC, and Arthur McKenna being one of the old boys that travelled through him is obviously a prominent member of the club. And I remember reading a book. It was Richard Jobson has been interviewed, Alex, and he spoke about going through on the Loughgelly CSC. He used to sit next to Arthur McKenna. You know, by the time I start going to the games, they're called the Arthur McKenna CSC. It's brilliant, just passing that baton down from generation to generation. Another thing, while we're on the subject of Fife, and I've mentioned Richard Jobson, we've had a fair few decent bands coming out of the villages as well, haven't we?
Yeah, well, actually, funny thing was, a guy called Michael, I think it's Michael Mlotkiewicz at Dunfermline.
Yeah.
He tweeted me an article I did about 30 years ago about five bands in a magazine called The Cut, which was like a Scottish music magazine. They were trying to make it the Scottish NME. And obviously, Skids, Big Country were mentioned, Rosillos, Faye Fife from Oakley. There was, and more mainstream, there was people like Barbara Dixon.
Yeah.
And I think Ian Anderson from Jethro Tull ended up in Fife as well. I don't know if he was a Fifer, but he certainly ended up living there.
Did Nazareth get a mention in your feature as well?
Yeah, how could I forget? Nazareth, Dan McCafferty, Pete Agnew. Actually, before I got into radio, I used to do mobile discos and residencies, and I actually used to do the Cross Ford. I used to do the Pitfern Arms and Cross Ford. That was my wee residency when I was in my early 20s. And Pete Agnew and Dan McCafferty used to come in for a wee drink because they lived in Cross Ford. And Nazareth's still huge. In fact, they had a song out a couple of years ago. Obviously, Dan McCafferty not with the band now, but Pete Agnew's still very much, you know, leading the line with Nazareth. I can't remember the name of the lead singer they've got now, but they had a song out a couple of years ago, Tattooed on My Brain, which was just an unbelievable... I mean, it was up there with Broken Down Angel and My White Bicycle and all the rest of them. What an incredible, incredible staying power. And I know Dan McCaffrey's got a solo album out just now as well. So, yeah, how can we forget Nazareth?
A couple of interesting things here. Mikey, who you mentioned, Mikey Mikovic, who used to work in Dunfermline as a general manager. I think Mikey probably was the youngest general manager in Scottish football at that time, because he was maybe in his late 20s, early 30s. And he's a very forward-thinking young man. And, you know, when he comes out with concepts, etc., they're always worth listening to. And it's a shame he's no longer involved in football, unfortunately, Alex.
I was just going to say, Paul, again, this sounds a bit like nepotism. But actually, Michael's grandfather was my first boss, because when I left school in the late 70s, I went to work at Halbeef Technical College in Dunfermline. And I was working with the Jannies. I was working with the janitors, £17.50 a week on work experience. And that was my first job, 6 months work experience. And Mikey's grandfather was the head janitor. There was three of them, and he was the head janitor at Halbeef Technical College in Dunfermline. So there you are. There's another random connection for you.
Mikey used to design. He had a big say in things like the design of the kits and all that kind of stuff. So he went right back to the old, you know, a retrospective nod back to the 60s with the candy stripes for the pars and all that. And he redone the badge to make it look more kind of traditional. So Mikey done a lot of good work up there, I've got to say. But you mentioned Nazareth. One thing about Dan McCafferty, he was a big influence on Axl Rose from Guns N' Roses. I mean, that's been mentioned as fact. You know, he played a big influence in Axl Rose. So, you know, some people may think Nazareth, you know, weren't a big band, but they used to tour with the Rolling Stones. There used to be a great pub in Dunfermline, Alex, with the old tour posters and all that were on the walls, you know. And it was the Rolling Stones with Nazareth supporting them. It was quite incredible. Hopefully there's a few other bands bubbling away just now that might come to fruition from Dunfermline.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, the whole Dunfermline music scene, I was very lucky to catch it late 70s, early 80s when I first left school. And they had the Kinema Ballroom, of course. And, you know, it's almost incredible to think now, but, you know, 40 years ago, I can remember going to the Kinema Ballroom, seeing The Selector, Elvis Costello, Madness, and, you know, people used to come to Dunfermline, big, you know, people that we regard as big names now from all over the UK used to come to Dunfermline because they knew there was a, to use the Paul McStay phrase, there was a buzz about the place. And the Kinema Ballroom, I remember late 70s, early 80s. I didn't go as much as I should have gone. But I can remember seeing some fairly big chart acts as they became in the Kinema Ballroom. And of course, that's where Nazareth started. They started as a kind of like a rock and roll band called the Red Hawks, and then they moved on to become Nazareth. And yeah, I mean, to answer your question, Paul, just an incredible, for a fairly small town, an incredible music scene, you know, almost like the Manchester of Scotland, if you like.
It's great. And it's great that currently, I think we've got a really good venue in PJ Malloy's, which is just a small pub in Dunfermline. They're doing some great things with live music. I mean, I seen Jake Bugg there the week that Jake Bugg went to number one with his debut album. And it was something they had booked in the calendar months in advance. And obviously the boy had exploded. But he kept his booking there, and he came and played at PJ Malloy's. And, you know, The £8 ticket, you could have probably sold it for £100 at that point, Alex. So to use that Paul McStay phrase, I think you're right, getting a buzz about the place is just something that brings back memories in the 1980s. And I'm going to ask you a question about the 80s, because obviously you've been an observer and a commentator on Scottish football. It's a thing that's come up, it's a subject that's come up a few times on a podcast about this Scottish football revolution of 1986, and Graeme Souness coming back from Sampdoria and joining Rangers as a player manager. And it is referred to as a revolution at that time. But I think when you look at the proud kind of European history of Scottish clubs, not just Celtic, who had a brilliant record in the 60s and 70s, but right into the 80s with Aberdeen and Dundee United. You know, after 1986, Alex, that really dried up. And even our, you know, World Cup record, qualifying for the World Cup finals, every 4 years we were there, you know, growing up, you almost took it for granted. But we look at it now, we've never achieved that since 1998. And my argument is, again, that it wasn't a revolution. It's just that when Souness came in, Rangers were the first club to go into debt, and then others followed. Celtic followed almost to their detriment. and other clubs followed as well. Then there was the influx of overseas players that up to that point, it was really few and far between, particularly at Celtic. We had very few overseas players at that point. Do you agree with the idea that, Souness was a revolution, or do you think Scottish football changed, but long term for the worse?
I would say that Souness turned the Scottish football into... I think Souness made the rest of the UK take an interest in Scottish football. I think before 1986, as far as I can remember, you know, there was kind of pockets where Scottish football would be featured on a UK level. But I think Souness coming to Rangers, suddenly, well, you know, they refer to Rangers as the quintessential British club. But I think when Souness came to Rangers, I think it was the first time the whole of Britain really took notice of Rangers and Scottish football. And I think a lot of people in England and in Wales and in, you know, and in even in Ireland suddenly realised how big this Celtic Rangers thing was. I think we always knew how big it was, but I think Souness coming to Rangers was the time when maybe London started to look up here. And, you know, you wonder, you know, if Souness hadn't been at Rangers, you know, you wonder if, you know, would the Sky deals have still happened? You know, I mean, I know Sky didn't come on until about 4 years after Souness joined Rangers, but would all that have happened? I don't know. It's hard to say. But certainly both Celtic and Rangers were spending like, you know, they were spending like English teams.
I've studied the Celtic response to that in great depth, obviously, because it was the beginnings really of the false economy of throwing money at players and bringing them up from down south, and it didn't work out for Celtic because the players simply did not perform, Alex, and then a few years later were facing financial ruin. At that time, when Fergus McCann came in and saved Celtic, which he absolutely, without a doubt, did, where were you in terms of Scottish football? Had you moved into the media side of things by then?
Yeah, I was kind of making a bid for a full-time media job. I was writing for an English football magazine at the time called Football Today, and actually my co-Scottish writer was Jim Craig.
Right.
And we used to do about 4 or 5 pages on Scottish football right in the middle of this magazine that was actually made and printed and published in the West Midlands. And 86, 87, 88, I was pretty prolific at that time. I was doing football writing as a second job. I was writing for Scottish Football Today. I was writing for Football Today. I was writing for The Punter when it came around. I was writing fanzine stuff as well. I had almost like this other persona as a fanzine writer. I wrote for The Absolute Game. I wrote for When Saturday Comes.
Okay, round 2. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
So I was in a funny position at the time because one minute I'd be writing a very kind of straight, almost tabloid, mainstream article for a Football Today or a Scottish Football Today. And then the next night I would maybe get my fanzine head on and I'd go and write a piece about Cowdenbeath for The Absolute Game or the Scotland national team for When Saturday Comes. And it was, late 80s, 86, 87, 88, 89 was when basically I was doing a lot of football writing as a freelance. And that led in a funny sort of way to me getting into broadcasting in 1990. So we had 4 years at the end of the 80s where it was a lot of writing. And then finally I got into what I really wanted to get into, which was radio. I had always done, you know, hospital radio on and off. And, you know, if podcasts had existed at that time, I would have been on a lot of podcasts as well, I guess.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you mentioned the fanzine culture. It's something, again, that on a Celtic State of Mind, we do talk about quite a bit. I was entrenched in the late 80s Celtic fanzines. And I think that was because there was really a cause at that time to have a fanzine and to have a voice that was separate from the official vehicle, which was the Celtic View at that time. So I immersed myself in things like Not the View, and latterly in Once a Tim, Always a Tim as well, but Not the View, which to this day still produces a monthly fanzine, is quite incredible. When you were writing for fanzines, Alex, was it under a pseudonym or did it all come under Alex Horsburgh?
Yeah, I just wrote it under my own name because, you know, I kind of wanted to get my name out there because I thought, you know, if I'm going to present a body of work to somebody, whether it be a newspaper or a radio station or whatever, I'm going to have my name on it. So that was, and luckily the unusual nature of my surname kind of worked in my favour as well because it was memorable. And the reason I wrote under my own name was because I thought, well, you know, I enjoy writing all this stuff, but I'm going to build up a body of work here. And I used to put a lot of this stuff in, you know, binders and stuff. And I always thought if somebody from full-time media ever wants to give me an interview, then bang, I can put that on the desk. And there it is. Not only can I do fanzines, I can do mainstream. And I had all my old hospital radio tapes as well. So I had shows on cassettes and stuff. So I was trying to build up a body of work, but, the fanzines were great. I guess the fanzines, in a funny sort of way, and you'll be able to relate to this, Paul, in a funny sort of way, the mainstream stuff for Football Today and Scottish Football Today, that was you. Like, that was almost like you being a holiday camp comedian, and then when you went to fanzines, you were allowed to be an alternative comedian, mm-hmm. if you know what I mean.
Absolutely.
And I enjoyed both disciplines because I did see them as disciplines, and it gave me an insight into how people think as well. And you know, I'm one of these people who I've got quite kind of wide taste in things. I don't usually judge a song by the band. If I like the song, I like the song. And I'm not ashamed to say it. You know, if I like an ABBA song, I'll say, I like that ABBA song. But if I like a Bon Jovi song or a Rammstein song, I'll say, well, I like that as well. And I think that's one thing I've had in my favour. You know, I'm not a keyhole person. I like to see bigger pictures, if you know what I mean, Paul.
We've mentioned my theories on 1980s football in Scotland. Moving into the 1990s, Alex, where, again, the fanzine culture was still prevalent. It certainly was. The terrace culture, a part of that was fanzines coming through. You've mentioned a couple of names there, actually, that I always look back fondly on Scottish Football Today. I love the fact that we had a magazine dedicated to Scottish football back then. And I don't know, actually, when that ceased publication, but I think it was before 2000. You might be able to correct me on that. Kind of 1990s was its heyday, as far as I remember.
Yeah, Scottish Football, Football Today, The Punter, they all kind of went by the wayside 92, 93, I think. And it was just kind of moving into that kind of 93 period that the mainstream magazines kind of went their separate ways because it was just impossible to sustain them. But the fanzines continued. I mean, I still did stuff for the Absolute Game. I can remember doing articles for the Absolute Game for the 1998 World Cup. Mm-hmm. And I know Archie McGregor, who was a St Johnstone fan. Archie was very much the brains behind it. I think he continued into the early 2000s. It also produced people like Christopher Brookmeyer, who is a well-known writer now. I think one of his books that I always remember is A Big Boy Did It and Ran Away. And Chris Brookmeyer and I think Rab Christie, who ended up becoming a scriptwriter on BBC Comedy.
Right.
These were all guys that featured alongside me in the credits on The Absolute Game. And I'm sure there was others as well.
The other thing about the 1990s, I had a very interesting interview with Jock Brown some time ago, actually, Alex. It was probably a couple of years back, but it was one of those situations, and you've probably been in this situation yourself, where I went home and listened back to the tape and the quality of the sound wasn't good enough to use it on the podcast. So it's there for me to go back and actually type it up at some stage. And it was a very good interview. But one thing he said that always sticks with me is, obviously his brother was the manager of Scotland in the 98 World Cup finals, the last time we reached the finals of any tournament. And he said that what Craig Brown wanted was for the SFA to invest. They had this money, I think it was something like £54-55 million. They had this money, a lot of that was through the lottery, but also prize money and this kind of thing. And Craig Brown wanted to invest it in grassroots football. And his kind of theory was that you could get £51 million pitches and erect them all over Scotland, get them right into all the wee villages and give the facilities back to these places that used to, you know, produce excellent world-class footballers. And obviously we pumped all the money into Hampden and offices and facilities, and we never ever did that. And it rang true when I was watching the World Cup finals, and Jurgen Klinsmann was one of the the pundits, Alex, and they were watching this Japanese team absolutely taking everybody by surprise. I think eventually they got beat by Belgium, didn't they, Japan? And, you know, at half-time, they were beating Belgium, I think, 2-0. And then Belgium came back, you might be able to correct me on that, and won 3-2, I think. And, you know, they say to Jurgen Klinsmann, and Klinsmann says, well, I'm not surprised, because 20 years ago, the equivalent of the Minister of Sport in Japan realised that there was all these empty tennis pitches. So what he decided to do was turn them into football pitches for all the different areas that kids could go and actually play. And because the facilities were there, they were used. And 20 years later, they're producing players that can play in the highest level of football. I mean, this is a debate that could go on and on and on. But, you know, from someone who's been watching the game for so long, Alex, why has our national sport deteriorated to such a degree that we just cannot compete at that level now?
I think it's all in your head, Paul. I always said, I said 1996 when Gary McAllister missed that penalty at Wembley. I had a debate with somebody after that game, the England-Scotland game, and I said, we need a sports psychologist. We need somebody in there, almost like a motivational coach, to say to players, believe in yourselves. I mean, I wrote an article a couple of days ago for the Football History Boys, and it was, you know, it was kind of plotting five great Scotland goals and goals that showed the kind of the Jekyll and Hyde nature of our national team. And I think we've always had the ability, Paul. I don't think the ability, I mean, I think in the last couple of years, okay, maybe the ability has dropped back a wee bit. But I would say until the mid-2000s, the late-2000s, you know, we still had some really good players. And I think with Scotland, it's a kind of psychological thing. I think it's almost like, I think we almost believe, we put ourselves in the underdog position. This kind of eternal underdog thing, this glorious defeat thing, it's really got into our DNA over the years. And there's something a bit perverse about the Scotland national team. They're, you know, I think they started to enjoy that glorious losers thing a wee bit too much. And I couldn't believe that even, you know, no disrespect to the women that played in the Women's World Cup, I couldn't believe that this kind of glorious defeat thing even bled into the women's game. You know, that Argentina game, when we were 3-0 up, and okay, it was a dodgy penalty decision and all the rest of it, but to be 3-0 up and to draw 3-3, to answer your question, Paul, there's something in the Scottish psyche, and it's something you can maybe explore, and maybe you've explored it already, but there's something in our psyche that makes us blow up, and it's incredible that we haven't yet qualified for the second stage of a major tournament, and it's incredible we've gone 22 years without getting to a finals of any sort. I think the ability has been there in the past, and I think the ability will come back. I think we've still got nuggets like Andy Robertson, we diamonds, if you like. Yeah. I think we need a sports psychologist. I think we need somebody to tell us. I was always in favour of Brian Clough becoming the Scotland manager. I know this is going back a bit, but I was always in favour of Brian Clough or even Terry Venables becoming the Scotland manager, because I think these managers would have told these players, you guys are good enough. And I know Craig Brown would say that as well, but there's just something, I think we need the psychiatrist couch for the Scotland team sometime, Paul.
That's interesting. And again, we're all very passionate about Scottish football, Alex, you know, and we're always up against it when you see some of the reports and the comments coming up from down south about our game, and we will protect it, you know, and it's the same for every team, every, you know, set of supporters. They're very protective of the Scottish game, so we do want to see an upturn in our national team's performances. Now, one thing that I do with Celtic supporters, Alex, is I do ask for the greatest Celtic 11 of their lifetime players that they've seen. But even though you're a Cowdenbeath fan, you've seen enough football in your football supporting life to be able to assemble a team for me and give me a greatest Celtic 11 if you are able. Could you do that for me just before we finish up?
Well, I would have to put Ronnie Simpson in goals, because not only because of the European Cup final, but because of the fact that he played in that 67 team at Wembley. I think he was 37 when Scotland became the first team to beat England, the world champions. So Ronnie Simpson in goal. Danny McGinn, of course, he's at number two, no doubt about it. I'd put Jim Craig at three, just because I've known Jim over the years, and Jim's a really good guy. And, you know, he is a gentleman in the true sense of the word. Paul McStay in the old right half position, if you like. Billy McNeil, of course, you can't leave Caesar out. I put John Clark in at six, again, not just because he was in that European Cup team, but he did a very good job as Cowdenbeath manager, believe it or not, in the mid-80s. Jimmy Johnson, Jinky at seven, for obvious reasons. Dalgleish at eight. Larson, it would have to be Larson up front. here's one for you. Joe Craig at 10. I worked with Joe early in my broadcasting career, and Joe was a very good pundit. I don't know why Joe didn't progress as a pundit in the early 90s or even into the 2000s. Joe was a very underrated striker at Celtic, and of course he holds the dubious honour of being the only Scotland player to come on as a sub, score with his first touch and never get picked again. And that was in 1977 against Sweden. I think he scored the third goal in a 3-0 win. He came on as a sub. First time he touched the ball was a header that made it 3-0, and he was never picked again. And I could never understand why Joe Craig didn't play more for Scotland. I think he's a very much an unsung Celtic hero. At 11, I don't know. I'll throw in a wild card. I don't know if he ever wanted to play for Celtic, but I'll stick Tommy Hutchison in at 11. And the reason I'll stick Tommy Hutchison in at 11 was, again, I think he was a very underrated player. Missed a penalty against Spain in the 70s, which kind of wrecked his career with Scotland. But my late father used to drink with Tommy Hutchison's father-in-law, and Tommy Hutchison used to get autographed Coventry and Manchester City programmes for me. He'd pass them on to his father-in-law, and his father-in-law would pass them on to my dad, and my dad would pass them on to me. And for years and years before I sold my programme collection, one of the big regrets in my life, I had a lot of Coventry and Manchester City programmes. And I always thought Tommy Hutchison was an underrated player. Aloha, Blackpool, Swansea, Man City, and Coventry. But I'll stick him in at 11 because I can't think of an 11 for Celtic. So there you are. There's a very unusual Celtic 11 for you, Paul.
You're allowed a wild card because one of the questions I do ask is, give us a player that you would have loved to have seen playing for Celtic. So we'll give you that. We'll give you Tommy Hutchison in the number 11 shorts, Alex. But I'll tell you, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking to you tonight about Scottish football, and also about your memories of Celtic and five bands of yesteryear. It's been an absolute pleasure, but let's do it again, and hopefully I can catch up with you after the lockdown's finished as well, Alex.
Yeah, absolutely, Paul. It's been a pleasure. It's been really interesting and really good. Yeah, it's been enjoyable. Thanks a lot, Paul.
Network. Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.